China says it will safeguard its oil deal with Iran and defend legitimate interests of Sino-Iran relations. The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says that Israel, the UK, and the US are the masterminds behind the Saudi war against Yemen. And Libya's new unity government demands the immediate withdrawal of all four mercenaries ahead of year-end elections. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. China has pledged to safeguard the country's oil deal with Iran and defend the, quote, legitimate interests of its relations with Tehran. The Commerce Ministry spokesman made that comment during a briefing. Gao Feng said that his country has not received notices of sanctions on Iranian oil from the new U.S. administration. The Biden administration has said that it will hold off on lifting sanctions unless Tehran comes back to full compliance with a 2015 deal. Tehran has rejected Washington's demand, saying it was the U.S. that abandoned the U.N.-endorsed accord, and so it needs to take the first step. Former President Donald Trump withdrew from the deal in 2018 and pledged to bring Iran's oil exports down to zero through his so-called maximum pressure campaign, but he never achieved that goal.
While on a visit to Europe, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has been discussing the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, with senior EU officials.
I welcome the Secretary's reaffirmation that the U.S. is ready to engage and the prospects of a U.S. return to the JCPOA.
For his part, Blinken seemed only interested in spinning anti-Iran rhetoric following meetings at the European Commission Brussels.
We talked about our shared goal of preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons.
Earlier, at NATO headquarters in the Belgian capital, Blinken spoke at greater length on the subject.
To look at how we might come back to compliance with the JCPOA, we said yes, and to date, Iran has chosen not to engage. So, as we've said, the ball is really in their court.
Even Iran's harshest critics might find Blinken's position difficult to grasp. After all, it was the U.S. that withdrew from the agreement in 2018, at a time when Iran was in full compliance, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Many analysts believe Joe Biden's administration is bowing to pressure from Tel Aviv to not engage with Iran. It has been suggested, however, that Benjamin Netanyahu does not speak for everyone.
There's many parts of Israeli society and even in the authorities that believe this deal will be better for Israel in the short, medium, even longer term.
The U.S. continues to impose illegal unilateral economic sanctions on Iran, despite the JCPOA having been underpinned by the United Nations. Tehran insists the current deal cannot be renegotiated, and the only fair and legal option for the U.S. is to rejoin the accord without preconditions. As the coordinator of the deal, legal experts say the ball is firmly in the EU's court and not Iran's. According to many analysts, Iran has demonstrated it is unwilling to remain in the JCPOA at all costs. Therefore, they say, the EU is clearly running out of time to save this landmark agreement. Jerome Hughes at the European Commission, Brussels.
Now, in other news, the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement saying that Israel, the UK, and the US are the masterminds of the Saudi-led war against his country. Abdulmalik Badruddin al-Houthi says that Washington and Tel Aviv chose Riyadh to shoulder the cost and the responsibility of the Yemen conflict. He blames Saudi Arabia and its allies for unknowingly following an Israeli agenda. Marking the sixth anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi onslaught, Houthi accused the coalition of deliberately targeting civilian gatherings and infrastructure. He said the coalition is paying terrorists to attack the Yemeni people. He added that innocent civilians are bearing the brunt of the Saudi-led war, which he described as an inexcusable crime. International calls have failed to stop the Saudi devastating onslaught, which has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly women and children.
The Saudi Aggression, War Crimes and International Collusion is the title of the sixth official report published by Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights in the capital Sana'a. The report concluded that the Saudi-led coalition committed thousands of war crimes against Yemeni women and children during 6 years of war.
The siege is one of the tools of the Saudi-led coalition to put pressure on Yemenis, and the U.S. bears responsibility. Washington is helping Riyadh in its crimes, and it is the one that prevents the United Nations from condemning Saudi Arabia. So the report focuses on international collusion, as it is one of the most important factors in committing more crimes against civilians in Yemen.
Officials said Saudi Arabia is still committing war crimes as it refuses to lift the siege in the country, depriving millions of Yemenis of food and medicine and causing more lives, especially for patients, amid the collapse of the health sector and the continued closure of Sana'a Airport.
The number of displaced is increasing and the humanitarian aid is not sufficient to fulfill their needs. The restrictions that were imposed by the countries of the aggression coalition against oil ships, food, and medical supplies are causing large spread of diseases, and also patients cannot travel outside the country. This has increased the number of deaths.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children. The United Nations described the situation in the war-torn country as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
6 years of war and the blockade and the suffering of the Yemenis is not yet over amid the continued silence of the international community. Yemenis believe that retaliatory attacks will pressure Riyadh to stop its years-long war on their country. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Now, moving on, Libya's new unity government has called for an immediate withdrawal of all foreign mercenaries ahead of the country's elections.
We reiterate the need for the departure of all mercenaries from our land and our nation and immediately.
Najla Al-Mangoush made a call at a joint news conference with her French and German and Italian counterparts in Tripoli. The presence of foreign forces is seen as a threat to the UN-backed transition leading to elections scheduled for December. The votes will be organized by a new unity government that took office in the North African country following a decade of chaos. The United Nations says that there are around 20,000 foreign fighters in Libya. Under an October ceasefire deal, foreign forces were supposed to leave the Libyan soil within 3 months. But the UN says there has been almost no reduction so far. It's news review time. Now, Taiwan is saying that it has started mass production of a long-range missile and development of three other models as part of its military modernization program aimed at deterring China. Taiwanese Defense Ministry called having a long-range attack capability a priority. President Tsai Ing-wen conferred the statement, saying that Taiwan needs to develop an asymmetrical deterrent with mobile equipment. Early this month, Taipei announced that it has also strengthened its deployment in a disputed South China Sea. Officials say the moves are aimed at confronting what they refer to as China's expansionism. China claims Taiwan is part of its territory under its One China principle. Now, a couple of people will be joining me to give us some more insight and information on this. We'll have Stephen Ruby, our own correspondent in Beijing, and Daniel Lazar, author and journalist, are joining us from New York. It's good to have you both on the show, gentlemen. Now, let's go to Beijing first, to Stephen Ribe. Stephen, this is what Taiwan is doing. Let's look at it from a Chinese perspective.
Well, I think it's very interesting what Taiwan is doing. I can give you a quick analysis if sure. I've got time. China has been stepping up the rhetoric. Xi Jinping has been calling the unification of Taiwan with the motherland inevitable. It's been stepping up military exercises. It's been sailing its ships close to Taiwan and flying planes close to Taiwanese airspace. And it's been increasing its military spending. At the end of the 1990s, China's defense budget was about twice the size, doubled Taiwan's. Now it's 25 times as big. Wow. It's got six times as many warships as Taiwan, six times as many warplanes, and eight times as many tanks. So it's looking that if it were just China versus Taiwan, and Taiwan would lose. So what it's doing, at least in some kind of symmetrical conflict involving their ships versus China's ships. So as you say, what it's doing is developing an asymmetric capability.
Mm-hmm.
It's been developing mobile land-launched anti-ship missiles. It's now developing a submarine fleet to sink Chinese ships. And as you say, now it's developing long-range missiles to hit not ships, Chinese ships, but Chinese bases inland in China. Now, the strategy of this conventional deterrence is to convince China that if it tried to invade, the cost of doing so would be so high in terms of Chinese ships sunk and other damage done that it wouldn't even be worth it, even if China won. And that's what military strategists call a Pyrrhic victory. So what about the U.S.? How does the U.S. fit in here? Well, the U.S. Might step up its defense of Taiwan, perhaps in the form of a security guarantee or a mutual defense treaty. But that's problematic for America, because if the domestic population in America might not have the stomach for a direct war with China. If America started losing aircraft carriers, for example, public support for a war with China from American public might be eroded very quickly. More importantly, a mutual defense treaty with America might make Taiwan bolder to the point where it feels free to start a war needlessly with China that would drag America in, and that war could even turn nuclear. So what it makes much more sense for America to give Taiwan the enhanced means to defend itself. And we've been hearing, for example, that America will be equipping Taiwan's new submarine fleet. I think a question that a lot of people will be asking is, will Taiwan develop new nuclear warheads to put on its long-range missiles? Well, the answer to that is absolutely not. It did have a nuclear weapons program before, but America put enormous pressure on Taiwan to make it stop developing nuclear weapons, simply because America does not want an ally that can start a nuclear war on its behalf. For example, if Taiwan started a nuclear war with China, America would automatically be involved.
Okay.
So that's what's going on. I think you could. Have now, I got a bit more time?
Okay, if you allow me, I'll go to New York. We don't have much more time. Okay. Thank you very much. That was a really thorough explanation. Good analysis. Now, let me ask Daniel Lazar in New York. Daniel, given the circumstances, and as Stephen also told us about it, and you see U.S. support for Taiwan, and China is sticking to the so-called One China principle, so should we be expecting a war around the corner?
Well, I certainly hope not. I mean, Stephen's analysis was really excellent and really brought the most important issues out in the open. But the U.S. is engaged in at least the beginnings of a major arms buildup in the Western Pacific. The Pentagon is talking about placing missiles in the Philippines and elsewhere in the region close to China. So the U.S. is following a very provocative policy, and it's undoubtedly urging Taiwan to move with all deliberate speed in terms of developing its own defensive capability. So China's got a real problem on its hands. It has a string of nearby neighbors with whom its relations have been rocky, and therefore they've provided an opening for the U.S. to insert its influence in the Western Pacific. So China, if it wants to avoid this kind of concerted opposition, should move very carefully but very quickly and very deliberately to iron out its differences with countries like Japan, the Philippines, Vietnam, etc. Because the more they're in conflict with these countries, the more the U.S. military buildup, the closer it will press to the Chinese mainland, the more threatening it will become. The more China will risk some kind of confrontation with the U.S. So China has got to revamp its diplomacy in order to undercut what seems to be a growing U.S. advantage.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much for that. We had Stephen Ribe, our correspondent, who joined us from Beijing with great analysis, and also Daniel Lazar, author and journalist, joined us from New York with his comments. Now let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. Beijing has urged Washington to halt what it calls discriminatory measures against Chinese firms.
We urge the U.S. to stop politicizing securities management, to stop discriminatory practices against Chinese companies, and to provide a fair business environment for companies from various countries.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry says that the U.S. action against foreign companies distorts market principles. Now, this one day after the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission announced implementing a new law that will remove foreign companies from stock exchanges if they do not comply with American auditing standards. In December, former U.S. President Trump signed the so-called Holding Foreign Companies Accountable Act into law. The implementation of the Trump-era policy toward China is expected to further tensions between the two countries. Moscow says it's ready to resume negotiations with NATO if there is a proposal for any such talks. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says that Moscow is prepared for equal, mutual respecting, and substantive dialogue. He said the Western Military Alliance has not come up with such an initiative so far, and that in reaction to remarks by NATO chief, who said that Russia has not responded positively to invitations for talks through a council that last met 2 years ago. Jens Stoltenberg said that the alliance regrets that there have been no meetings since then. Ties between the West and Russia have hit new lows over differences on a host of issues, ranging from the conflicts in Ukraine and Syria to allegations of interference in U.S. elections. A number of European countries are seeing record jumps in their COVID numbers as a third wave of the pandemic sweeps through the continent. Poland has reported an all-time high of more than 34,000 new COVID-19 infections. The government has announced more restrictions for the next 2 weeks as it's facing a lack of hospital beds and ventilators. Ukraine also posted a record number of new daily cases. It logged 362 fatalities, shattering previous record tallies for a third straight day. In Germany, over 22,500 people contracted COVID-19, the highest daily figure since early January. On Wednesday, the government there backtracked on a plan for further restrictions over Easter amid public backlash. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Dark Review. Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In this episode, we'll be reviewing award-winning film Terror, directed by David Felix Sutcliffe and Lyric Cabral. Joining me in the studio today, we have Tim Roby, a film critic for the Daily Telegraph, who is also a regular guest on BBC Film 2017 and the UK's Radio 4 film programme. And Raza Nadim, who is head of Muslim Public Affairs Committee UK and who has been involved in anti-Islamophobia campaigning for over 10 years. Now, Terror is the first documentary to place filmmakers on the ground during an active FBI counter-terrorism sting operation. The film delves into the dark world of FBI informants, government surveillance, and the US's so-called war on terror. Thank you both for joining the show. So this film won an award at the 2015 Sundance Film Festival. Tim, if I could start with you, what was your general take on the film?
Well, it held quite a lot of value for me as an expose. Certainly it kind of opened a window on the world of counter-terrorism sting operations, which I had not really witnessed before. It does claim to be the first example of this kind of filmmaking. And I was troubled by it in various ways, but quite productively, I think, on the whole. And it led me in a direction which resolved some of my issues with the initial approach. I thought as it went along, I found that the characters came into closer focus, and I began to understand the issues involved, and it began to really convince me and win me over with its argument, essentially, which is that the FBI have crossed a line since 9/11 and are beginning to criminalise in kind of quite an outlandishly unfair way behaviour which really shouldn't be criminalised.
Mm. And you, Raza, how did you find the film?
I mean, it's the talk of counter-terrorism and informants and, you know, and within the Muslim communities, especially within Britain and America, lots had been written in the past about it. So this really was quite interesting to see it happening in front of you. Really felt like you were on the journey with them as they were following, you know, the protagonists and on the sting operation. So, I mean, in that sense, it was good because it no longer was an academic study or someone just, you know, an article where someone is posing questions saying, have things gone too far? What happens to our liberties, etc.? You were watching it in action. I think from that perspective, it was great. But I think also because it showed for people like myself and other Muslim campaigners that this isn't just based on hearsay, this isn't just based on people kind of on conspiracy theories. This is actually happening. And that actually, in many cases, being done by people who aren't that good. And you're right, a line has been crossed in many ways. So I think for me, this was good because it arms us with the argument about how surveillance has gone too far.
Mm. I want to talk about a little bit about the beginning of the film. I think it's quite a symbolic scene where we see a little girl singing the national anthem, the US national anthem, and specifically the filmmakers include the lyrics, "Land of the Free, Land of the Brave." Tim, why do you think that was such a significant scene to include in the film?
I think you've sort of answered the question. It very much is a film about freedom and a film about the freedom of expression. Essentially what happens over the course of the film is that some beliefs held by the targets of these sting operations on social media and elsewhere become a basis on which to prosecute them. And I really don't think we should be prosecuting people for beliefs. It actually amounts to thought crime. By the end of the film, I really thought it had made that case very convincingly with especially two of the examples that it chooses in terms of the victims. But then there's also the perpetrator of the sting, the main figure in the film, who is a very interesting and troubled figure in his own right, and clearly has a lot of issues. And really, a lot of the film is asking whether this kind of case should be entrusted over to a personality like that. Very early on, we hear the point made that informants for the FBI can be really quite bad people, because you're having to break faith with a lot of relationships that you build up. And the kind of person who would be willing to do that and willing to essentially betray confidences and friendships in this way, you wonder if they're verging on sociopathy, and I think that is an issue.
That was the actual phrase they used, wasn't it? In the radio thing, you hear them in the discussion, actually, it is quite sociopathic to be able to build such a close relationship with someone and then kind of stab them in the back almost, you know, take something out of context or whatever. But also, you know, that the land of the free bit, for me, one thing that really stood out was because it showed that Saeed Sharif, whatever you want to call him, that he believed in the American dream, and he talks about having a bakery, etc., and whatnot, providing for his child, and how this was an avenue to make some money.
I think that line also stood out in that way because, I mean, the American anthem is used in everything in America, right? From sports events to classrooms to whatever, you name it.
That's very true. And I want to pick apart Saeed's character a bit later on.
What is the map on the wall?
Why is the what?
Why is the map on the wall?
Find my locations around here.
Is there significance to the red lines?
Yes, 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 yes. It's regarding the work I do.
No, I'm going to give you the picture. I'm going to put them up on here. It'll be better for you because I don't want to explain nothing to you. You got it, that's it. Don't ask no question who they are. Give me something that you shouldn't be seeing anyway. For some reason, they got a big population of Muslims that come from the various countries over there to come to school here. Moroccans, Somalis, Saudis, and then they all go back from where they come from. I don't have no feelings for them. You're making the Islam look bad. You gotta go.
Raz Zaid's targets were all Muslim from various ethnic backgrounds. What do you think of the way the FBI targets their victims or their targets, and are they justified in doing so?
Well, see, the thing is, the whole argument about racial profiling comes into the equation. I mean, there's a great book called The Muslims Are Coming by Professor Arun Kunani, and he talks about actually how the same tactics that were used with COINTELPRO and the Black Panthers, you know, by the government and by J. Edgar Hoover, have kind of were essentially kind of copied and just kind of using a cookie-cutter approach, just put onto the Muslim community, and that actually how they just said, well, if they're Muslims, they're a suspect community, and they were only viewed through the lens of the war on terror. And that's why when he says, because actually he says that clip goes on saying, you know, isn't it strange all your suspects, your targets are Muslims? He goes, yeah, well, what can I say about that? And I mean, he doesn't want to delve more into it, but it's true, the FBI, there have been a disproportionate number of targeting of Muslims, and part of it is and now we see with Trump as well, that how the CVE operations, the Countering Violent Extremism operations, are focused solely on Muslims. They're seen as the sole perpetrators of terrorism. And that was part, and that kind of really clouded the judgment, and does still cloud the judgment, of security services who only kind of view Muslims and Islam through that lens.
And Tim, the FBI seems to prey on vulnerable targets in this film. What do you make of Saeed's character?
Yeah, I mean, vulnerable is certainly one word for him. He is rather a tragic figure, really. I mean, he's acting almost entirely out of self-interest and expecting to get more profit from this situation than he actually receives. There are these sort of scenes of him complaining that he's not being given enough, literally enough cash in the envelope that he's receiving. He seems disgruntled and oppressed at all times. But he's also very kind of cut-off individual. He's a real sort of solo operator and a loner. There are a few scenes with his family, but on the whole, he's just going solo on these missions. And he seems very disconnected from the Muslim community, except to the degree in the sense of him actually feigning kind of interest in what they're doing and kind of stepping in there and kind of pretending, talking the talk, if you like, just in order to elicit the kind of supposed kind of information about them that the FBI is hoping for. And not only to elicit it, but to kind of coax out beliefs and comments that can be used against them, which they might otherwise not make. And that really is almost the definition of entrapment.
Would you agree with Tim?
Oh, definitely. And I think with Saeed, I mean, he is a vulnerable character. But also the bitterness comes out of it's that self-interest, because he actually, in the long term, when you start to analyse what he's doing and what he's hoping to gain, you realise there's actually not much to gain at the end of it, because he has to be aloof from the Muslim community because he's spying on Muslims. But secondly, it's his work has meant, when he has been found out in the past, when you've seen the documentary, it's meant he doesn't form any real bonds. Like, he really is cut off, partly because of his work, and it's just made him a real bitter individual. So when he says, you know, they're giving Muslims a bad name, that for me was an off-the-cuff comment. He doesn't like other Muslims after a while, and that really comes across that he has an issue with other Muslims.
Yes,
but
definitely.
He also wants that friendship and that community, but he knows he can't get it being in this line of work, but he's chose to be there. You can see why he's such a troubled individual.
From the film, we learn that 9/11 changed the FBI's tactics when it comes to dealing with criminals. So we find out that before 9/11, the FBI would investigate crimes after they've been committed. But then after 9/11, the FBI sought to try and prevent the crimes from happening. Now, Tim, what are the moral implications of this, and can the FBI prevent a crime from happening before it's even been committed. And in a sense, doesn't that make them complicit in that they're paving the way for that crime to occur?
Well, it's certainly a slippery slope. I mean, if a credible bomb threat were to be issued, then of course they're going to investigate that. That's a crime that they're going to want to prevent. And I think prevention is better than cure in that respect. I mean, let's agree that we would rather that bomb did not go off, almost certainly. But if there's no such bomb, and if they're merely waiting to find what kind of person might one day light the fuse to that bomb, long down the road, then you have to ask them at what point they step in. Because if they step in prematurely, that is prosecuting individuals really illegally, I think. And I think in the case of the figures that we find in this film, they are so far away from that end game of actually lighting the fuse, if you like, that really they're being almost encouraged further down the road than they would otherwise go. There is a continuum there, and they are some way down that road, I will concede, because some of the beliefs that they hold would be considered quite unpalatable, I think, to non-Muslims. But nonetheless, this is thought crime if you're going to try and prosecute it.
I mean, in Hollywood films, we're used to seeing the FBI depicted as some kind of sleek and high-technology organization. But what do we learn about their methods in this documentary, Raza?
I think what really comes across is just how human they are, and how in this, like, they are kind of wading through the darkness trying to make sense of this all. They've got an objective, which is stop terrorism. But then from there on out, it's kind of figure out, lads. And it's just so strange because, you know, when he says in that little clip where he says, oh, you know, they go by the book, you're just an individual. You're not an expert in any way, shape or form apart from you're a member of a community, right? And even then an isolated figure at that. And so what, you're the expert now in this relationship with the FBI? It's so strange in the whole thing. And when you're watching, you realize, oh my God, they don't really seem to know much about what they're doing. I mean, like, you know, they're so used to the kind of crime apparatus that they have is to deal with, you know, to deal with crime once it's happened, to deal with petty theft, criminals in that sense. But terrorism, it does, you can just see that they are incompetent in many ways. That's what really comes across for me, that they don't actually know what they're doing. And I think also that with the FBI thing, what you get from the documentary is that actually how they have kind of jumped into the deep end, and now they're trying to stay afloat, but they're struggling. Like, you know, for example, before 9/11, they only had a couple of, was it 1,500
That's right.
informants?
Yeah.
And after 9/11, it goes up to 15,000,
yes.
Right? That's ridiculous. I mean, that level, to jump to that scale, and they've not managed it, and that really comes across in the documentary.
You really hope that those 15,000 aren't all like Saeed, because it is the phrase that comes to mind is the blind leading the blind, really, yeah.
So let's now talk about Saeed's target in this film, Khalifa. Tim, how is Khalifa portrayed in this film, and are we made to feel sympathetic to his innocence and him being framed?
Yes, I mean, just to add, the phone number there, the fact that he finds it through one Google and is able to kind of discover that the guy's an informant, I mean, talk about ineptitude, that's kind of the ultimate. But yeah, Khalifa's story in this film is a very valuable additional layer, I think, especially when the filmmakers get access to him personally and start to talk to him. Saeed doesn't know that that's happening. And I think it really it enhances the film's perspective quite a lot, and I think it becomes a much stronger film as soon as he is a main figure in it. Because early on, all we have is the kind of layer of his identity that essentially Saeed is working with, his Facebook page and his social media profile. And some of the stuff he's saying is quite provocative. It is quite leading, in a way. You can understand why the powers that be might consider him a person of interest, at least. But, of course, Saeed then pushes him further down that road, and he becomes very suspicious. And the more we get to know him, actually, the more we discover someone who seems actually a very peaceful individual, with a beef against the US government, for sure, with a very sort of particular set of political attitudes. Mm-hmm. But they are completely within the what you would call the not harmful category. And the fact that he is sort of this major figure in this sting, you just wonder, are there not other people they should be looking at really rather more urgently than him? And I think by the end of it, you found him to be a rather sympathetic figure indeed, and someone who's been unfairly blamed for things he hasn't really committed to.
Mm. Raza, how do you think how fair it was to target Khalifa by the FBI?
Well, see, the thing is, it's what's come out over the last couple of years is how there's a use, they have profiles that they've made and algorithms that are used for this kind of work. And the reality is, there's no real profile of a terrorist. It's, they come in all different shapes and sizes. And the problem with using algorithms is that you could take any sort of political comment made by a Muslim and say, this leads them to that road, leads them to violence. I mean, and part of the kind of counterterrorism mindset in this country and in America has been that non-violent extremism leads to violent extremism. And in kind of with that net, you end up catching almost anyone that makes any sort of political comment. And you see, that's how he's been caught, really, on that basis. I think one line that really stood out for me is when he says, I knew he was FBI. That bit, I thought, I've had some... I know that kind of... That way, the tone that he used, I've seen that from other Muslims in conversations, where the problem... What this documentary really shows, right, for me, is that it's made Muslims more... they don't trust other Muslims off the back of this because they feel that there's informants within the community. And you see all the time, now that guy might be a spy, I don't really trust him, he might be undercover, etc. So when he says that, it shows that actually his way, that you have to be aware of that kind of problem within your community to be thinking that way. And that's what really came across to me in that scene, and generally, at the end, that the issue of spying on Muslims, people are aware of it, and they're wary of it, and it makes them... they don't trust their own fellow Muslims, and within the community, you see that breaking apart.
Would you like to jump in there?
Yeah,
Tim?
There's one thing, a question I'm not sure the film really asks, but really you have to consider, in the case of someone like him, if he is put away for a crime like this, when he comes out of jail, what's his attitude going to be? I mean, this is a way to radicalise people more than anything else, I feel.
Mm-hmm. And last 30 seconds to you, Tim. What do you recommend that people watch this?
Yeah, I do think it's a film worth watching. Very much, I hope that there are further investigations done along these lines because it's something that does need to be revealed to a wide audience. And I think as filmmaking, it is actually extremely well crafted as well. I think the footage they get from both of these major interviews is extremely strong and kind of correlates very well with their main argument. And yeah, I was impressed with it.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and for you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
They came to the King Super's grocery store on a grey Monday afternoon, fulfilling life's little missions. One woman was picking up a prescription. A retiree was fetching an online order for her side gig delivering groceries. A 25-year-old manager was at the front of the store, as always, happy to help. Then for the second time in less than a week, another workday American scene was shattered by a gunman's deadly rampage. This one more than 1,000 miles from Atlanta, Georgia, where families of the 8 people killed in another shooting spree are still planning funerals. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Jack Healy and Nicholas Bogle Burrows. The piece is titled, Boulder Shooting Survivors Describe Listening to Him Kill Everyone You Know. Stay with us for more of Jack Healy and Nicholas Bogle Burrows' article. Came to the King Super's grocery store on a grey Monday afternoon, fulfilling life's little missions. One woman was picking up a prescription. A retiree was fetching an online order for her side gig delivering groceries. A 25-year-old manager was at the front of the store, as always, happy to help. Then, for the second time in less than a week, another workaday American scene was shattered by a gunman's deadly rampage. This one more than 1,000 miles from Atlanta, Georgia, where families of the 8 people killed in another shooting spree are still planning funerals. By the time it was over, 10 people were dead, including a Boulder police officer and at least 3 King Super's employees. And people across Colorado, a state scarred by the legacy of the 1999 Columbine High School attacks and a barrage of other mass shootings, wondered in grief and fury how it had happened again in their state. Their college town of Boulder, their neighborhood supermarket. It's overwhelming, said Frank DeAngelis, the former principal of Columbine High School, whose phone rings so often after new mass shootings that he has become the state's grief counselor in chief. Colorado's been through so much, he said. Law enforcement officials said the 21-year-old suspect, Ahmad Al-Aliwi Alisa, had been armed with a handgun and military-style semi-automatic rifle and was wearing an armored vest when he carried out the attacks. In a detailed affidavit, investigators said the gunman began the rampage in the store's parking lot, then pushed inside. Police officer Eric Talley, a 51-year-old and 11-year veteran of the Boulder Police Department, was the first officer to reach the scene. Officers who swept into the store soon after found him with a bullet wound to the head and dragged his lifeless body back outside. The authorities identified the 9 additional victims as Denny Stong, a 20-year-old, Nevin Stanisic, a 23-year-old, Ricky Olds, 25, Trelona Bartkowiak, 49, Suzanne Fountain, a 59-year-old, Terry Leica, 51 years old, Kevin Mahoney, 61, Lynn Murray, 62 years old, and Jody Waters, 65 years old. Relatives and friends reached for celestial metaphors to describe the victims on Tuesday, 23rd of March, calling one woman a comet flaring across the sky and another a beam of light. Chief Maris Herold of the Boulder Police Department struggled to hold back her grief at a news conference in which she hailed police officer Eric Talley as heroic in his final call as a police officer. King Soopers workers said their slain colleagues had diligently worked on the front lines throughout the pandemic, only to find themselves in the crosshairs of America's relentless plague of mass shootings. Maggie Montoya, a pharmacy technician, was helping with coronavirus vaccinations when gunshots boomed through the aisles at about 2:40 p.m. on Monday, 22nd of March 2021. A bullet cut down one of the patients who had been waiting in line. "Active shooter," screamed the manager, and the workers and customers scrambled for their lives. As the gunshots drew closer to the room where Ms. Montoya, a 25-year-old, and a colleague huddled together in hiding, she said she stopped trying to dial 911 and instead called her parents. "I wanted to hear their voice, for them to hear my voice in case it was the last time," she said in an interview on Tuesday, 23rd of March. Mr. Alisa, who was shot and wounded in his leg, was charged with 10 counts of murder and was booked into the Boulder County Jail on Tuesday after being released from hospital. He faces a possible penalty of life in prison without the chance of parole if he is convicted. Colorado abolished the death penalty last year. Law enforcement officials did not offer a motive for the attacks and said they were just beginning to sift through a sprawling crime scene and unravel Mr. Alisa's past and his actions in the days leading up to the attack. The Arvada Police Department said that Mr. Alisa had been convicted of third-degree assault, a misdemeanor, in 2018 for a November 2017 incident in which Mr. Alisa cold-cocked another student during class, then punched him in the head several more times. Mr. Alisa said the classmate had called him racial names weeks earlier, Arvada records show. He was also arrested on a criminal mischief charge in 2018. His brother, Ali Aliwi Alisa, 34-year-old, told CNN that the suspect had grown increasingly paranoid starting around 2014 and believed he was being followed, chased, or investigated. He once covered his computer's camera with a duct tape to keep from being spied on, his brother said. The shooting incident touched off anguished new cries for tougher gun laws that reverberated on Tuesday, 23rd of March, from Colorado, where Democratic lawmakers are pushing for a 5-day waiting period on gun purchases, to the White House. President Joe Biden, saying he and the First Lady were devastated by the attacks, made a new call to impose laws banning assault rifles and high-capacity ammunition magazines. "This is not and should not be a partisan issue. It is an American issue," President Biden said. "We have to act." The shootings in Boulder, Colorado, which appeared to be the deadliest in Boulder County's history, cut a deep gash across Colorado communities that have been jolted again and again by sickeningly familiar active shooter alerts. Since Columbine, there have been deadly public shootings at multiple high schools, a movie theater in Aurora, and Planned Parenthood Clinic in Colorado Springs, and on and on. Colorado politicians talked on Tuesday about how they had shopped at the market that was now a bloody crime scene or personally knew a victim. They struggled to describe the grief and outrage of confronting a mass shooting in their backyard just 6 days after the shooting incident in Atlanta, Georgia. Flags had barely been raised back to full mast after the tragic shooting in Atlanta that claimed 8 lives, and now a tragedy here close to home at a grocery store that could be any of our neighborhood grocery stores, Colorado's Governor Jared Polis said at a news conference. State Representative Tom Sullivan, whose son Alex was among the 12 people killed in the Aurora Theater attack in 2012, said the Boulder shooting demonstrated the urgency of passing new gun control laws. The state legislature is considering bills that would require guns to be locked or secured in houses with children, and to require gun owners to report any lost or stolen guns to police. Mr. Tom Sullivan is also pushing for Colorado to pass a 5-day waiting period on gun purchases. I know what last night was like, he said, referring to the long wait before some families learn they will never be reunited with their loved ones. Across Boulder, the shoppers and workers who barely escaped the gunfire said they were still raw and numb and could barely begin to grieve. Kimberly Moore, a 35-year-old, a pharmacy technician, said the gunman's rampage ended not far from the room where she and her co-workers were hiding. For half an hour, she said, they stayed as quiet as they could, hoping that their face masks muffled the sound of breathing. Ms. Moore said she could hear the gunman firing what sounded like 2 deliberate shots into people. You're sitting there completely exposed, listening to him kill everyone you know, she said. Deb Grosjean, a victim's advocate with Boulder Police Department who spent hours with witnesses on Monday night, said one woman who survived the attack had recently moved from Dallas to Colorado in hope of finding a safer place to live. The woman told Ms. Grosjean that she and 2 other employees hid upstairs in a storage closet. We think it's inconceivable that this could happen in Boulder, but it's proof it could happen anywhere, Ms. Grosjean said, and then asked a question swirling like the snow that crept over the mountains late on Tuesday. When is enough enough?
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.